All right, so today we're going to take a deep dive into a Supreme Court case called Fortuño de Villegard.
Oh.
And basically what happened was this case kind of throws a bit of a curveball when it comes to, like, how we think about trials being fair.
Yeah.
Because essentially it kind of gets at the idea of, like, just by being present in court, which is your right can actually potentially be used against you when you're trying to defend yourself.
Yeah, that's right. It's a
pretty wild idea.
Yeah, it's a really compelling area where, like, constitutional rights and courtroom strategy kind of, like, butt heads.
Yeah.
And to really, like, unpack that, I think it's helpful to kind of get into, like, the nitty-gritty of the case itself.
Okay, cool.
So this case, it involves a guy named Ray Agard. He was convicted in New York for sodomy and weapons charges.
Okay.
And, you know, the outcome of the case really hinged on whether the jury believed him or the victim.
Right. So it's a real he said, she said kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Credibility was, like, front and center.
Yeah.
And so during the closing arguments, you know, sometimes they call that a summation.
Yeah.
The prosecutor made this point that, like, you know, Agard had a unique advantage because he sat through the whole trial and heard everyone else testify.
Oh, wow.
Right. And so the implication there, the unspoken implication is that, well, he could have tailored his story accordingly.
Right, right.
Like, he heard everyone else, and so now he knows what to say.
Yeah, that's super messed up.
Yeah, and so Agard's lawyers, they objected right away.
Yeah, of course.
You know, argued that this, like, violated his constitutional rights.
Of course.
And so that kind of brings us to, like, the core tension here, right?
Yeah.
Like, the uncomfortable truth that this case forces us to grapple with is, like, can our right to be present?
Yeah.
To see our own defense actually weaken our defense.
Right, because he has to be there.
Yeah, he's required to be there.
Like, it's his right to confront the witnesses against him. And just in general, due process means, like, he needs to be present for the proceedings.
Exactly, yeah. It's a Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses.
Right. And then, yeah, just general due process concerns require him to be there.
So how can they then be like, oh, well, the fact that you were here listening means that, you know, like, you're less credible, or that you're somehow, you know, doctoring your own story.
Yeah, that's the real rub, right? Like, he's compelled to be there.
Right.
And then they use that against him.
So what happened then?
So the trial court allowed it.
Really?
And, you know, that led to Agard's appeal.
Okay.
And he argued that, you know, these comments infringe on his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, his Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses, and his 14th Amendment right to due process.
Okay, wow. He brought out the whole Constitution.
Yeah, he was not messing around.
Yeah.
And the Second Circuit Court of Appeals actually agreed with him.
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of what, you know, brought it up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And so the big question for them was, like, okay, can a prosecutor basically imply that a defendant shaped their testimony just because they were there for the trial?
Right. Because, like, I mean, anyone would do that if they were in that situation.
Right.
Like, if you're sitting there, you're accused of something and you hear everyone's story, of course you're going to be like, okay, well, I need to make sure that, you know, my story lines up, or, like, I'm addressing the points that they made.
Exactly. Yeah. It's, like, basic human nature.
Yeah.
And so Justice Scalia.
Oh, Scalia. This is going to get.
Yeah. He wrote for the majority.
Okay.
And he basically said, like, no, this doesn't automatically mean it's a constitutional violation.
Okay.
And they had a couple key reasons.
All right. Let's hear it.
So the first one was they drew a distinction from Griffin v. California.
Griffin v. California. What was that one about again?
Yeah. So just to, like, quickly recap, Griffin basically said that prosecutors can't comment on a defendant's silence at trial to imply guilt.
Right. Right.
You know, like, you can't say, oh, they didn't say anything, so they must be guilty.
Yeah.
And so Scalia argued that, like, you know, commenting on a testifying defendant's presence and the potential for tailoring is different.
Okay. So how is it different?
So it's not about, you know, assuming guilt from silence. It's about, like, assessing the credibility of the testimony itself.
Okay.
And the majority's reasoning was that jurors might, like, naturally consider this possibility anyway.
Okay.
Like, that someone who testifies last, you know, might have adjusted their story after hearing everyone else.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, like, if you're sitting there listening to everyone else and you get to go last, like, it's only natural to, like, make sure that your story fits in with everything else that's been said.
Right. And so the idea is, like, the prosecutor is basically just verbalizing something the jury might already be thinking.
So it's like they're already thinking it, so might as well just say it out loud.
Right. Exactly.
I see that part.
Yeah. And then the second point that the majority made was about historical precedent.
Okay.
You know, they were basically saying that, like, historically, courts have allowed challenges to a testifying defendant's credibility.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so, like, pointing out this opportunity to tailor testimony is, in their view, just another way to do that.
So it's like part of the whole adversarial system.
Yeah.
Where, you know, each side is trying to poke holes in the other side's case.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when a defendant decides to testify, they're basically subjecting themselves to scrutiny, just like any other witness.
So you're saying it's like, if you choose to get in the ring, then you're fair game.
Yeah, basically.
I mean, I see that point, but it still seems kind of iffy to me.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, it's like a juror might be thinking it anyway, but isn't there like a huge difference between like a juror just like having that thought themselves?
Yeah.
And then the prosecutor like explicitly saying it out loud?
Right.
Like, doesn't that give it more weight?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what about the fact that, like, the defendant being there isn't optional?
Right.
You know, it's not like a normal witness who just, like, chooses to show up that day. Yeah. You have to be there.
Right.
So it still feels like a pretty big difference to me.
Yeah. No, those are really valid points, and that's where, like, the third part of the majority's reasoning comes in.
Okay.
So they acknowledged that New York law, like, in many places, requires a defendant to be present at their trial.
Right.
But the court said that, like, this requirement doesn't mean you're automatically immune from having your credibility questioned.
So just because the state says you have to be here doesn't mean that they can't then use that against you.
Right, essentially.
Wow, that seems really unfair.
Yeah, and they also dismissed the argument that the timing of the comments, like the fact that it was during closing arguments rather than cross-examination, made them inappropriate.
Oh, so they're saying it doesn't matter when they say it, it's still fair game.
Basically.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. So I know that there was a pretty strong dissent in this case.
Yes.
What did Justice Ginsburg have to say about all of this?
So Justice Ginsburg's dissent, I think, really gets to the heart of the tension we were talking about earlier.
Okay.
She argued really forcefully that this decision basically turns this fundamental right, the right to be present at your own trial, into a disadvantage,
yeah,
into a liability.
That makes sense.
And her main point was that if all defendants are required to be present,
yeah,
then accusing them of like tailoring their testimony based on that presence doesn't actually help us figure out who's innocent and who's guilty.
Right.
You know, it just creates this catch-22.
Right. You have to be there, but then you're penalized for being there.
Exactly.
It's like damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, and she felt that this really undermines the fairness of the whole trial process.
Of course, yeah.
And
what about Justice Stevens? He had a concurring opinion, right?
Yes, he did. He wrote separately.
And what is his take?
So he agreed with the majority that, like, the prosecutor's comments weren't enough of a constitutional violation to overturn the conviction.
Okay, so he's with Scalia on that.
Yeah, on that point.
Okay.
But he strongly disapproved of the tactic itself.
Okay, so he's like, I don't like it,
yeah,
but I don't think it's against the Constitution.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, he called the argument demeaning to the adversary process and just bad policy, even if it was technically legal.
Okay, so it's like he's saying, like, yeah, you can do it, but you really shouldn't.
Right, and he even suggested that states could and maybe should ban these arguments outright.
So he's like, states, you should probably take care of this.
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. So, like, overall, you know, he didn't think it was unconstitutional, but he definitely didn't think it was a good way to run a trial.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically the Supreme Court gave prosecutors the go-ahead to make these kinds of arguments.
Right.
But it seems like there were some pretty serious reservations from within the court itself.
Definitely.
So
yeah.
What's been, like, the lasting impact of Portuondo?
Right. So the court didn't, like, lay out a super strict step-by-step test.
Okay.
But they did highlight some factors that courts should consider when they're evaluating these kinds of comments.
Okay. Like what?
So things like whether there's historical precedent for these arguments.
Oh, right.
Whether the comments place a burden on a specific constitutional right.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they actually relate to the defendant's credibility as a witness,
yeah,
and ultimately whether they help the truth-seeking function of the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And so because there wasn't a really rigid test,
yeah,
Portuondo basically gives prosecutors some leeway to make these arguments.
Okay.
But as Justice Stevens pointed out, states can still make their own rules and potentially restrict these comments.
Okay, so it's kind of like a state-by-state thing.
Yeah, there's some variation.
So, like, what does all of this mean for, like, a regular person?
Right.
Like you or me,
mm-hmm,
who might end up in some legal proceeding someday.
Yeah.
You know, maybe as a defendant or even just as a witness. Like, imagine you're on trial.
Yeah.
You've been sitting there listening to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's your turn to speak, the prosecutor's basically like, oh, well, you've just tailored your story,
right,
based on what you've heard.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty scary thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for a defendant who's trying to decide whether to testify,
yeah,
Portuondo is a big reminder that that's a potential risk.
Right.
Like, if you choose to take the stand, the prosecution can now argue that your testimony might have been influenced by everything you heard before.
Yeah.
And they have the Supreme Court's backing to do it.
Right.
So it's definitely something that defense attorneys need to talk about with their clients when they're figuring out whether or not to testify.
Yeah.
It adds a whole other layer to that decision.
Yeah. It really makes you think about, like, the balance of power in the courtroom.
Definitely.
Like, on one hand, the prosecution has to be able to test whether someone's telling the truth.
Right.
But on the other hand, we have all these rights that are supposed to protect the accused.
Yeah.
It feels like Portuondo kind of shifts that balance a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
So where does that leave us?
Well, I think it raises some really important questions about fairness and the presumption of innocence. And it kind of brings us back to Justice Ginsburg's question in her dissent.
Yeah.
Like, if the law says everyone has to be present at their trial, does accusing them of tailoring their testimony really help us figure out who's innocent and who's guilty?
Right.
It's a really profound question. And what does it say about our justice system if a right that's meant to protect you can be used against you?
Yeah, that's something for everyone to think about, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely food for thought.
All right, well, that's our deep dive into Portuondo v. Agard.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.